Help keep our community safe and healthy during National Prescription Drug Takeback Day, October 25th. Find a collection site near you at DEATakeback.com. Do your part to lower overdose deaths and prevent drug misuse before it starts.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. We're the place that plunges headfirst into worlds that are, well, unapologetically raw, often pretty shocking, and I think always thought-provoking.
Definitely.
Today, we're preparing to immerse ourselves, really get into the universe of a comedian who doesn't just push boundaries in stand-up, he kind of redraws them completely.
Yeah, he really does.
We are talking about Doug Stanhope.
Ah, Doug Stanhope. He's definitely more than just a comedian, isn't he? He's an author, an actor, political activist, podcast host.
A multi-hyphenate, for sure.
Exactly. A true multi-hyphenate.
Yeah.
And his material, it's just defined by these profane confrontational observations about life. It's intense stuff.
It really is.
And our sources, they give us this like fascinating roadmap through his whole journey, you know, from his formative years back in Massachusetts all the way up to his latest projects.
So that's what we're doing today. We'll be navigating the complexities of his persona, trying to understand the why behind the what.
Right. Why does he do what he does?
Exactly. And uncovering how his just completely unfiltered honesty has carved this unique path. And let's be honest, often a very controversial path in comedy.
No doubt about that. Controversial is definitely the word.
That's right. So our mission today is to unpack the man behind the microphone. We'll trace his early life, look at how his provocative humor evolved, dig into his unconventional views, and highlight those moments that defined his career, you know, both on and off the stage.
And you, listening, you might find some of his perspectives, well, challenging. Maybe even uncomfortable at times.
Oh, definitely uncomfortable.
But guaranteed, you're going to find them thought-provoking. We're aiming to pull out the most important nuggets of knowledge, the key insights, to give you a shortcut to being really well-informed about this truly singular voice in comedy.
Okay, let's get into it then. Let's unpack this. We start our journey in Worcester, Massachusetts. That's where Doug Stanhope was born, March 25, 1967.
Great, Worcester.
And his early life, it presents some really intriguing contrasts. Like right from the get-go, his mother, Bonnie, she was a waitress. You know, navigating that everyday grind of the service industry.
Yeah, tough work.
Meanwhile, his father, Russ, he headed the science department at Stanhope's school. So completely immersed in the logic and structure of academia.
Wow, that's quite a difference. Waitress and science department head.
Exactly. Can you just imagine a young Doug sort of absorbing these two vastly different worlds all under one roof?
It's incredibly fertile ground for a critical observer, isn't it? I mean, that dual exposure could have just deeply influenced Stanhope's later material.
How so, do you think?
Well, it allowed him to view society from multiple angles, often conflicting ones. His comedy, it frequently dissects the hypocrisy embedded in those societal layers, doesn't it?
Yeah, I see that.
Like, he often satirizes the whole American dream ideal. He contrasts that gritty reality faced by working class people, maybe like his mother experienced, with the, you know, the detached theoretical pronouncements from more educated or privileged figures, like maybe his father's world represented to some extent.
So those early observations from this kind of dual household, they became like a filter for him.
Exactly. A filter allowing him to expose the absurdities, the double standards that, frankly, many of us just overlook. It really it lays a foundation for a mind that questions norms right from the very beginning.
And it wasn't exactly a smooth childhood either. His parents divorced when he was just 10 years old.
Yeah, pretty young.
Following the divorce, his mother, Bonnie, she quit drinking, which is significant, and moved down to Florida. Doug and his older brother, Jeff, they stayed living with their father, Russ.
Okay, so mom moves away, dad's the primary caregiver.
Right. And that early age of divorce, combined with his mother's struggles with alcohol, you have to think that could have been pivotal in shaping that cynical worldview we recognize in his comedy.
Oh, absolutely. It often is.
But how do you think significant childhood events like that, you know, parental divorce, a parent struggling with addiction, how do they often become the wellspring for an artist's unique perspective, even if that perspective is, well, dark or cynical like Stanhope's?
That's a really crucial question. For Stanhope, I think this period undoubtedly contributed to his readiness to tackle really sensitive family topics, often with just brutal honesty in his stand-up.
Yeah, he doesn't hold back on that stuff.
Not at all. Many artists draw directly from their deepest personal experiences, right? Mm-hmm. And those early formative years, they provide such rich, even if painful, material. And living with his science-oriented father and brother after the divorce, Well, it suggests an environment that, well, maybe stable on the surface.
Okay.
It might have lacked certain emotional outlets, perhaps, or maybe the kind of unconditional nurturing that could soften a child's view of the world.
Interesting. So maybe more logic, less overt emotion.
Possibly. It could have pushed him towards more independent thought, more observation, forcing him to analyze the world around him with this sort of detached, almost scientific rigor.
Which definitely sounds like his comedy style.
Exactly. That style would later define his comedic dissection of human nature. It's almost like a perfect breeding ground for someone who would later challenge conventional narratives and, you know, personal sensitivities. He learned to look at things critically early on.
Absolutely. And the signs of this unconventional path, they showed up remarkably early. Get this. At age 12, a school psychiatrist actually wrote a letter to his mother.
Oh, wow. At 12?
Yeah. Expressing concern over Stanhope's tendency to sketch, and I quote, gory images and adult-themed cartoons.
Gory images. Okay.
The psychiatrist even went so far as to suggest he was, quote, in need of professional help.
Yikes. That's pretty heavy for a 12-year-old's drawings.
And this wasn't just some fleeting phase either. He quit school entirely at 15.
15.
Which just further illustrates his rejection of conventional paths. That early diagnosis, though, suggesting he needed professional help for sketching gory images, it feels almost prophetic, doesn't it?
It really does.
But do you think it was genuinely a sign of trouble back then, or was the psychiatrist maybe just struggling to categorize a mind that was already operating way outside the box?
That's a fascinating distinction, isn't it? And I'd lean heavily towards the latter. I mean, society often pathologizes what it doesn't understand, right?
True.
Especially in kids who deviate from expected norms. Those early sketches, I don't think they were just about shock value. They might have been his earliest form of visual satire.
Huh. Like early comedy.
Yeah, maybe a premonition of the black comedy to come. A mind already seeing the world differently, unafraid to explore darker themes, mm-hmm. challenge societal taboos.
They're not necessarily troubled, yeah. Just different.
Exactly. These indicators suggest a predisposition for confronting norms, a comfort with material most people would shy away from. Quitting school at 15 just reinforces that early autonomy, that clear rejection of traditional structures. He opted instead for, like, a self-directed learning curve that eventually led him to the stage.
Right.
It speaks to this innate irreverence that became a hallmark of his persona. Not necessarily a need for help, but maybe a need for an outlet that school just couldn't provide, pushing him towards that path less traveled.
Before he fully jumped into comedy, though, Stanhope had some rather, let's call them unique ventures.
Oh, yeah. Like what?
He worked in telemarketing, and he openly described it as, quote, borderline legal stuff, trying to scam people, basically.
Wow. Okay. Straight from the horse's mouth on that one.
Right. But his early comedy influences, they lean towards the more surreal and intelligent side. He cited Monty Python and National Lampoon.
Ah, Python and Lampoon. Makes sense.
It's quite a mix, though, isn't it? You've got the street-level grit of scamming people over the phone, combined with the sophisticated, subversive wit of his comedic heroes.
It's an intriguing combination, absolutely. And it's where you can really see the foundational elements of his distinctive comedic voice starting to take shape. How do those two things connect, the scamming and the Python?
Well, that experience in borderline legal telemarketing, it could have inadvertently honed his confrontational style and his ability to read and maybe even manipulate an audience.
Ah, I see. Like practicing persuasion.
Think about it. In telemarketing, you're constantly pushing boundaries, trying to persuade, facing rejection nonstop. Those are skills that are remarkably transferable to insult comedy, to the art of provocation on stage.
Good point.
Then you couple that with influences like Monty Python, where he absorbed this comfort with the absurd, the non sequitur, a certain intellectual mischievousness that just subverts expectations.
Yeah, classic Python. And National Lampoon, which definitely honed his ability to deliver biting social commentary wrapped in irreverent, often dark humor. Put it all together, you get this powerful blend.
So it's like he learned to craft a comedic experience that was smart, shocking, and surreal all at once.
Exactly. Blending that street-level grit with this more sophisticated, subversive wit he got from his influences.
Okay, so we've just painted this really vivid picture of his formative years. A life steeped in contrasts, unconventional choices.
Definitely not the standard path.
Right. But how did this unique crucible of experience, you know, the boundary-pushing sketches, the cynical observations, those borderline legal sales pitches, how did that finally translate into the stage persona we recognize today?
Yeah. How did Doug Stanhope, the man, become Doug Stanhope, the uncompromising comedian?
Let's trace those initial steps onto the comedy stage. Let's discover how he began to build that unmistakably raw brand. This brings us to the segment we call The Stage Awaits, building the Stanhope brand of comedy.
All right, the Vegas years.
So after this rather unconventional upbringing and these formative experiences, Stanhope finally stepped onto the comedy stage in the 1990s. He kicked off his stand-up career in 1990. He was 23.
Yum guy.
First performance was at an open mic night at a Las Vegas bar. He really developed his act there in Vegas before moving over to Phoenix, Arizona. That's where he landed a pretty crucial gig as a house MC at a comedy club.
Right, the house MC gig. That's huge for stage time.
Describe what that period in Vegas might have been like for a burgeoning, raw talent like him.
Well, imagine him, right? Young 23-year-old stepping into that neon glow, but also the, you know, often seedy underbelly of a Las Vegas bar, ready to unleash his observations for the very first time.
Seems fitting for his style.
Totally. Starting in Vegas, a city built on spectacle, excess, and just unconventional entertainment. It seems almost predestined for Stanhope's style, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That environment where irreverence and pushing limits are often celebrated, it provided this unique testing ground for his emerging voice. It wasn't the, you know, the traditional clean-cut path into comedy.
And the MC role?
Oh, the role of house MC especially. That would have given him extensive, consistent stage time. A true laboratory for refining his profane and confrontational observations. Night after night.
Practice, practice, practice.
He could experiment, push boundaries, hone his ability to connect with an audience, even if that connection was achieved by challenging them, making them squirm, or forcing them to confront uncomfortable truths. It was like a baptism by fire that really shaped his unique delivery.
He wasn't always a fan of the main comedy hubs, though, which is, I think, a key part of his whole outsider identity.
Right. He bristled against the mainstream scene.
Yeah. In 1995, he settled in West Hollywood, but he famously hated so much of it, partly because he saw this slump in comedy acts at the time, maybe saw it as a dilution of the art form.
Hmm. Quality control issues in his mind.
Could be. And while he did perform at regular spots, you know, the Hollywood Improv, the Comedy Store.
Legendary clubs.
Legendary, yeah. But he ultimately preferred working in clubs outside the city center, places like Playa del Rey. What does that tell us about his approach to comedy, even early on?
I think this period is incredibly revealing because it highlights his early aversion to what he considered the mainstream or maybe diluted aspects of comedy.
He didn't want to sell out, basically.
It seems like it. For Stanhope, it wasn't about being seen in the right clubs or, you know, rubbing shoulders with the right people. It was about the authenticity of the performance and connecting with an audience that was willing to actually engage with his material, not just passively consume it.
So choosing the margins deliberately.
I think so.
Okay.
His preference for working outside the central Hollywood scene suggests a conscious, deliberate choice, either to cultivate a niche audience or maybe just to operate in a less commercially driven, more artistically authentic environment.
Makes sense for him.
It's really a foundational statement about his inherent need to forge his own path rather than conforming to industry expectations or chasing that typical Hollywood dream. It signals his uncompromising commitment to his own voice, even if it meant taking a harder road.
And he had this brush with mainstream TV around then that really underscores that independent spirit, that artistic integrity.
Right, of the sitcom story.
Yeah. He actually landed a development deal and flirted, as he put it, with producing a sitcom. He even co-wrote a pilot episode with a writer from the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Wow, that's a big deal. Mary Tyler Moore Show writer. That's legit pedigree.
Totally. But Stanhope later described his own script as, quote, a piece of shit.
Chuckles. Okay, blunt as ever.
And said he felt truly thankful it was never picked up. That's a pretty strong rejection of a potentially huge, lucrative path, isn't it?
It's absolutely crucial in understanding Stanhope's artistic integrity, his unwavering rejection of what he saw as compromised material. This wasn't just a casual dismissal. It was a profound statement about his commitment to his voice, his vision.
He wouldn't dilute it.
Exactly. His refusal to dilute it for commercial appeal. I mean, think about it. How many artists dream of that kind of development deal? But Stanhope walked away because it didn't align with his authentic self.
So it raises the question, how often do artists flirt with those mainstream opportunities? And what does it really take to walk away when it doesn't feel right, even if it means sacrificing money and fame?
For Stanhope, it was clearly a defining moment. It solidified his path as this uncompromising artist who would rather be true to his unique, often dark comedic voice than chase mainstream success with material he didn't believe in. He'd rather be, you know, poor and authentic than rich and creatively stifled.
Well, his talent was clearly undeniable, even if his choices were unconventional. In 1995, Stanhope won the San Francisco International Comedy Competition.
Help DEA keep our communities safe and healthy by participating in National Prescription Drug Take Back Day, Saturday, October 25th. Take action right in your own home by cleaning out your medicine cabinet of unneeded medications. Keep them safe, clean them out, take them back. Find a collection site near you at DEATakeBack.com. Do your part to lower overdose deaths and prevent prescription drug misuse before it starts. That's DEATakeBack.com.
Right, it was big.
And notably, he triumphed against none other than Dane Cook in that three-week contest.
Dane Cook, who became this massive arena act later on.
Exactly. So winning against him back then, that's pretty significant, right?
Oh, definitely. It was an early and significant validation of his talent. Showcase his ability to connect with audiences, impress critics, even with his burgeoning, unconventional style. It's a testament to his raw comedic power, for sure.
And his life after leaving Worcester? It was just a testament to his restless spirit. He moved around constantly. Florida, back to Massachusetts, Oceanside in California, then Idaho.
Idaho, okay.
Before eventually landing back in Las Vegas and then finally settling in Bisbee, Arizona in 2005. This nomadic existence just seems to fit the persona he was cultivating.
It really does. His continuous relocation, moving from place to place, from the sunshine of Florida to the desert of Arizona. It suggests this restless spirit, right? A perpetual search for a place that truly resonated with his unique lifestyle, his philosophical outlook.
He wasn't looking for suburbia?
Clearly not. He wasn't settling for the conventional. And ultimately, he found that sense of belonging, that community, in Bisbee, Arizona.
Tell me about Bisbee.
It's this remote, eclectic kind of bohemian town. And it became almost synonymous with his independent spirit, his anti-establishment ethos. It's a place that seems to allow him the freedom to live and create totally on his own terms, far away from the perceived phoniness of Hollywood or other major cities.
So Bisbee itself became part of the Stanhope brand.
In a way, yeah. Became a character in his own ongoing narrative, a fitting backdrop for him.
Okay. So with his comedic voice really solidifying, Stanhope was ready to unleash it on an unsuspecting public. And this led to some truly memorable and often very controversial moments.
Uh-huh. The provocation ramps up.
His refusal to back down, even when facing outrage, really began to define him. Let's dig into these instances in our next segment, The Art of Provocation, Confrontation and Controversy.
All right, buckle up.
So Stanhope's career trajectory really took a sharp turn into the truly confrontational, especially in the period after the September 11 attacks.
Yeah, that was a turning point for a lot of comedians, how they handled it.
Right. And following those horrific events, he received significant criticism from audiences for comments he made regarding 9/11. And this wasn't just like online hate mail.
Right.
No, it included actual protests outside his gigs and even reports of physical attacks on stage.
Wow. Physical attacks. That's intense.
For many comedians, that would be it. Career over, or at least a major pivot. What does this incident reveal about Stanhope's commitment to his material and his view of comedy's role, especially in times of national tragedy?
This incident, I think, powerfully demonstrates his steadfast, almost unyielding commitment to his material. Even when faced with widespread public sensitivity and clearly genuine personal danger.
Oh, he just wouldn't back down.
No. It profoundly highlights his belief that comedy should not shy away from challenging narratives, even deeply painful ones. For Stanhope, comedy isn't just about making people laugh.
What is it about then?
It's about forcing them to think, to confront uncomfortable truths, to question official or widely accepted narratives, no matter how raw or recent the trauma might be.
That's a tough line to walk after something like 9/11.
Extremely tough. In moments of national tragedy, the public often craves solace, unity. But Stanhope intentionally opted for dissection, for provocation.
Which leads to the big question.
Right. It raises that important question for us, for you listening. What role, if any, should comedy play in such sensitive times? And how do we distinguish between genuine artistic expression that pushes boundaries and what some might see as just insensitive provocation?
Where's the line?
Exactly. For Stanhope, it was clear. He viewed his role as someone who, regardless of the discomfort or the personal cost, had to speak his truth, pushing boundaries others wouldn't dare approach. He saw it as a necessary function of comedy to cut through the sentimentality and get to a different kind of truth, however ugly.
He also had some truly, let's call them unbookable moments when performing abroad. These became almost legendary and really cemented his reputation.
Ah, yes, the international incidents.
Like in June 2006, at the Cat Laughs Comedy Festival in Kilkenny, Ireland, about 10 minutes into his set, he makes this joke.
Oh boy. Which one was this?
The one about Irishmen committing pedophilia because of the, quote, ugliness of Irish women.
Oof. Okay. Yeah, I remember hearing about that one.
Now, regardless of how you feel about the joke itself, that caused an immediate and intensely hostile reaction from the audience. It led to the cancellation of all his remaining appearances at the festival.
Not surprising, really. That's hitting multiple nerves at once.
It wasn't just a misstep, though, was it? It felt like a deliberate provocation.
Absolutely. That incident showcases his absolute willingness to push cultural boundaries, his complete disregard for what might be considered safe or culturally appropriate material. It exemplifies the extreme risks he takes with his humor and the very real, immediate consequences that can follow.
He's like testing the audience.
Exactly. He's not just telling jokes. He's performing an experiment on the audience, pushing them to confront their own biases, their cultural sensitivities, their limits of acceptance.
Right.
In that case, the reaction was swift and decisive.
He found the line pretty quick there.
He hit a raw nerve, definitely. Not just with the subject matter, but the specific cultural targeting of the joke. It's a clear demonstration of how his brand of comedy operates right on the razor's edge, constantly testing the limits, knowing full well that some lines, in certain contexts, will lead to immediate, forceful rejection.
And maybe for him, that rejection is almost a sign he's doing his job.
Could be. Almost a validation that he's making people profoundly uncomfortable, which seems to be part of the goal.
And it didn't stop there. Later that same year, in August, he returned to the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, another huge international comedy event.
Right, Edinburgh. Known for being pretty open-minded, usually.
Usually. But at one particular show, one of his routines sparked a, quote, violent affray with an angered audience member. It actually led to police involvement and him having to leave the venue.
A violent affray. So, like, a fight broke out because of a joke.
Apparently so. What's even wilder is that on his opening night at that Fringe, he reportedly took what was believed to be an ecstasy tablet, handed to him by someone in the audience.
Wait, what? He took a random pill from an audience member? Before or during the show?
The reports say on opening night, so likely before or early on, despite all this chaos, police, angry crowds, maybe unexpected substances, he still managed to get 5-star reviews from the press.
That's almost unbelievable. The dichotomy is just staggering.
Right.
I mean, picture this scene. Police lights flashing, an angry crowd, a performance maybe on the brink of collapse. And Stanhope, who hours before might have taken an unknown pill from a stranger, is still captivating critics enough to earn top marks.
How does that even happen?
It truly paints this vivid picture of Stanhope's performances as these unpredictable, boundary-pushing experiences, often blurring the lines between traditional comedy and just raw performance art.
It's more than just jokes.
Exactly. The stark contrast between the chaos, the police, the alleged drug use, and the critical acclaim is particularly telling. It suggests that even amidst the pandemonium, there was this undeniable artistic merit. Right. A compelling truth in his delivery, a raw, dangerous energy that resonated with those willing to look past the controversy.
So the danger was part of the appeal for critics.
It highlights that for some critics, the sheer audaciousness, the unpredictability, the unfiltered honesty, that's precisely what makes his work stand out and earn praise. He pushes boundaries so hard that even when things go totally sideways, the artistic intent and impact are still undeniable.
He even managed to turn his experiences within the comedy industry itself into a kind of comedic stunt. At the 2008 Fringe, Stanhope announced A Day with Doug.
Oh, I remember this. The pay-to-hangout thing.
Exactly. Offering the rather exorbitant opportunity to spend an entire day with him for $7,349.
7,000 pounds. Why that specific odd amount?
It wasn't arbitrary. It represented the average amount that comedians apparently lose when they get booked at one of the 4 biggest venues at the festival.
Wow. So he's basically saying, this is how much it costs me to be here, so pay up if you want my time.
Pretty much. What a way to comment on the economics of comedy.
That stunt truly reveals his sarcastic wit, doesn't it? And it served as this biting meta-commentary on the often harsh economic realities and absurd expectations within the comedy industry.
Turning his loss into performance art.
Precisely. By turning his own potential financial loss, the very real cost of performing at a major festival, into this unique meta-comedic experience for anyone willing to pay. He transforms a personal challenge into a critique of the system itself.
Classic Stanhope move.
Totally. Find the absurdity, highlight the hypocrisy of an industry that often expects artists to suffer for their craft, and then cleverly sell it back to the audience. Turning a potential failure into this unique, exclusive experience. It's a brilliant, cynical, and deeply Stanhopean way of saying, this is what it costs to be me, and if you want to experience it, you'll pay for the privilege.
Beyond the live stage, Stanhope also ventured into TV and media, but as you'd expect, always on his own terms, usually with a subversive twist.
Yeah, his TV stuff was interesting.
In July 2002, Fox aired back-to-back episodes of his hidden camera show, Invasion of the Hidden Cameras. It was a project that actually began way back in 1999.
Hidden camera, okay. Seems up his alley.
But Stanhope later accused another show, Spy TV, of stealing half of his ideas, noting their subsequent good ratings. And then, kind of ironically, he even starred as one of the pranksters on Spy TV himself.
Wait, he accused them of stealing ideas and then worked for them?
Yep. What does this tell us about his early foray into TV and his view of the industry?
Well, this early venture into TV definitely showcases his longstanding interest in subversive humor and pranks. It's a natural extension of his confrontational style.
Makes sense.
But it also quickly exposed his cynicism regarding the industry's practices, especially around intellectual property. The accusation of idea theft isn't just a personal grievance. It's a commentary on the cutthroat nature of TV production, how concepts can be appropriated or diluted for broader appeal.
And then working for them afterwards.
His willingness to then appear on Spy TV after accusing them of theft is also classic Stanhope, isn't it? Engage the system, maybe take the money, but always maintain that critical distance, that cynical eye. It just reinforces his anti-establishment stance, even when working within the establishment itself, highlighting those inherent tensions between artistic integrity and commercial pressures.
Then came a much more mainstream, yet still pretty edgy, venture. In 2003 and 2004, he co-hosted the fifth and sixth seasons of The Man Show with Joe Rogan.
The Man Show. That was a big platform.
Huge. And he agreed to do it, as he put it, for financial stability. A very practical motivation for an artist known for his anti-commercial stance.
Gotta pay the bills, even if you're Doug Stanhope.
Right. And the segments on the show really captured his provocative spirit. He famously lasted 5 rounds boxing Tonya Harding.
He boxed Tonya Harding.
Yep. Lost by decision, but still, he's like 5'7". And in a truly classic Stanhope move, his own mother reviewed pornographic films on the show.
His mom reviewed porn on TV.
Yes. How did these segments manage to integrate his personal life and provocative style into a broadcast show like that?
Well, this period definitely highlights a more practical, maybe even pragmatic side to Stanhope. His willingness to engage in more mainstream, albeit still edgy, entertainment for very clear financial reasons. Mm-hmm. It's a testament to the need for artists, even the uncompromising ones, to, you know, make a living.
Sure.
But what's fascinating is how, even within a broadcast show like The Man Show, he managed to integrate these highly personal and provocative elements that were authentically Stanhope.
Like the boxing and his mom.
Yeah. The Tonya Harding boxing match speaks to his willingness to engage in these physical, absurd spectacles, often at his own expense. But the segment with his mother reviewing porn, that's particularly telling.
Why so?
It wasn't just a cheap gag. It felt like a deeply personal, almost meta-comedic extension of his willingness to explore uncomfortable family dynamics in public.
Yeah.
Blurring the lines between his personal life and his stage persona in a way that truly resonated with his brand of humor. It showed that even when he was doing something for money, he found a way to make it uniquely and provocatively his own.
He also made a bunch of other memorable TV and film appearances showing his diverse reach. He hosted Girls Gone Wild, America Uncovered in 2005.
Chuckles. Okay, that feels pretty on brand.
Right. Appeared in the film The Aristocrats, telling that infamous joke to a baby.
The Aristocrats. Yeah, his segment was memorable.
In 2011, he was on the FX series Louis as Eddie Mack, a comedian Louis C.K. knew. Apparently, he initially tried to beg out of it because he thought he was a terrible actor, even auditioned online via Skype.
Huh. Trying to get out of a role on Louis. That's funny. Yeah. Shows his self-awareness, I guess.
Yeah. He also recorded vignettes for Charlie Booker's shows, Newswipe and Weekly Wipe, where he was humorously dubbed the Voice of America.
Ah, Brooker stuff. He was great on that. Perfect fit. Cynical outsider perspective.
He had a supporting role as a cop in Chris Rock's movie Top Five and even popped up on Bar Rescue as John Taffer's guest.
Bar Rescue. Okay, that's random. quite a varied portfolio.
It absolutely is. And these diverse appearances showcase his broad reach across different media, from hosting controversial shows to cameos and providing that distinct, often acerbic commentary.
And his reluctance for the Louis role, trying to beg out of it because he sucked at acting, that's quite telling, isn't it?
How so?
It underscores his self-awareness about his perceived strengths and weaknesses, emphasizing that his primary comfort zone is still that unfiltered stand-up where authenticity reigns supreme over polished acting.
Right. He's a stand-up first.
Yet, even in a small role, like in The Aristocrats telling that dirty joke to a baby, he brings his signature subversive edge. And being the voice of America for Charlie Brooker, that highlights how his cynical yet insightful perspective was valued even internationally as a unique take on American culture. It shows his specific brand of commentary has wide appeal, even when he feels outside his comfort zone.
Despite these mainstream flirtations, Stanhope also actively cultivated his own independent ventures, really solidifying his identity as an outsider. He established the Unbookables.
Right, the Unbookables Tour.
A group of touring comics, artists like Andy Andrist, Brendan Walsh, others who shared that similar uncompromising style. Their first CD, Morbid Obscenity, came out in 2006. Why was it so important for him to create his own platform like that?
That initiative, I think, further cements his identity as an outsider. Huh. Someone who wasn't content to just wait for opportunities, but actively created his own platform for like-minded, uncompromising comedians. The Unbookables wasn't just a tour, it was a statement.
A middle finger to the establishment, maybe.
Kinda, yeah. It reinforced his unbookable persona, demonstrating that if the mainstream wouldn't fully embrace his style or the style of his peers, fine. He'd build his own stage, cultivate his own audience.
The DIY approach.
Totally. This DIY ethos is perfectly aligned with his broader philosophical outlook. If the system doesn't serve your needs, build a new system. It provided this crucial outlet for comedians who, like Stanhope, prioritized raw honesty and offensive material over commercial viability, fostering a community of artists who refused to self-censor. It's a powerful example of taking control of your creative output and distribution. Very punk rock approach to comedy.
Okay, so we've explored the evolution of Stanhope's provocative humor on stage and screen, but his unfiltered honesty, his refusal to sugarcoat anything, it isn't just confined to his comedy routines, is it?
No, not at all. It spills over.
It spills over uncompromisingly into his political views, his personal philosophy. It forms a kind of manifesto for an anarchist's approach to life.
Yeah, his worldview is deeply embedded in everything.
Let's delve into the ideas that truly fuel the man behind the microphone. This brings us to the Anarchist's Manifesto. Political views, and personal philosophy.
All right, the philosophy deep dive.
Doug Stanhope's political identity is definitely not straightforward. It's been a journey in itself. While his views often led people to think he was maybe a liberal, he explicitly rejected that label.
Yeah, he pushed back hard on that.
Then he described libertarianism as a phase he went through, using a rather graphic analogy.
The one about being 12.
Yeah, saying it was like blowing each other when we were 12. And then by 2017, he fully described himself as an anarchist. That's quite an evolution, isn't it? From what people might assume to full-blown anarchism.
It's an absolutely crucial evolution in his political identity, and it's key to understanding his profound political disillusionment and his increasingly radical views. That graphic analogy for libertarianism, it vividly highlights his dismissive attitude toward conventional political labels and systems, suggesting a youthful, perhaps naive, phase he felt he outgrew.
So anarchism was the endpoint of that disillusionment.
It seems so. What's fascinating is his journey from these flirtations with established ideologies to a complete rejection of them, ultimately embracing anarchism. This signifies a profound skepticism of all forms of centralized power and an unwavering belief in individual autonomy, which really underpins so much of his comedy and his personal philosophy.
So he's not just a rebel.
No, he's someone who deeply distrusts institutions and believes in the individual's right to self-governance above all else. His anarchism isn't necessarily about chaos for chaos' sake, but more about questioning authority relentlessly and advocating for maximum personal freedom.
He did have some early, albeit unconventional, forays into political engagement that kind of hinted at this independent spirit. Back in 2004, he endorsed the Free State Project.
Ah, the Free State Project, the move to New Hampshire idea.
Yeah, that proposed political migration of at least 20,000 libertarians to a single low-population state, aiming to make it a stronghold for libertarian ideas. Stanhope believed this, quote, could produce tangible change in our lifetime.
Interesting. So he saw potential in that direct action.
Then, in 2008, he actually announced his intention to seek election as U.S. president on the Libertarian Party ticket.
He ran for president. Seriously.
Well, he announced it, humorously stating it seemed like a funny thing to do, but people were either amused or horrified. His stated focus was individual freedom, self-government, and making America fun again. It almost sounds like a stand-up routine turned into a political platform.
It absolutely does. But these early forays into political activism, even when approached with that comedic or ironic twist, they clearly show a genuine desire for systemic change, I think.
Even the presidential run.
Maybe. His endorsement of the Free State Project reveals a belief in tangible, if unconventional, political action, seeking to create a living experiment in libertarian principles, not just debate them. Even his presidential bid, while maybe partly a jest, still articulated a serious focus on individual freedom and self-governance ideas he clearly holds deeply.
So he uses humor to make a serious point.
Exactly. He blends his subversive humor with this genuine yearning for a different societal structure. He makes light of the political process, uses it as material, while still engaging with its core ideas, highlighting the absurdities he sees in traditional governance and offering this radically different vision of what a fun America might look like under principles of extreme personal liberty.
Stanhope also has very specific stances on various social and political issues, and he's never afraid to voice them loudly, often using his platforms to do it. For the 2012 presidential election, for instance, he originally supported Ron Paul.
Ron Paul makes sense, libertarian leanings.
Right. But later, he endorsed the actual libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson. This shows a certain fluidity in his allegiances, doesn't it? He's not rigidly partisan.
Yes, it certainly does. It demonstrates his fluid allegiance. He aligns with individuals rather than strictly adhering to party lines, especially when those individuals champion ideas of individual liberty that resonate with his own evolving political thought.
He's not a party man.
No, he's an idea man. He gravitates towards those who, in his view, best represent the principles of freedom and limited government, even if they aren't always consistent across the traditional political spectrum. It's about the philosophy, not the party machine for him.
A particularly striking example of his activism came in 2013. He showed up at a Bisbee, Arizona city council meeting.
Oh, the Bisbee meeting. For civil unions?
That's the one. To support civil unions for gay couples. Mm. And he famously stated, quoting directly here, I am not gay, and I think marriage is stupid. I have no dog in this fight except human equality.
Classic Stanhope. Dismisses the institution but defends the right based on equality.
Exactly. What's even more indicative of his core beliefs is that he was apparently shaking with rage because the meeting began with a prayer.
Shaking with rage over a prayer.
Yeah. He emphasized, quote, I thought it was absolutely abhorrent that this would open with a preacher preaching Jesus in a city function. The measure, by the way, eventually passed 5-2.
Wow.
This isn't just about supporting gay rights, though, is it? It feels like it's about a deeper philosophical stance.
Oh, this incident is incredibly revealing. It goes far beyond simple support for a social issue. It shows this clear, unwavering commitment to human equality, even when it conflicts with his personal disdain for institutions like marriage.
Finds marriage stupid, but defends the right.
Exactly. Yet he vociferously defends others' rights to it, based purely on equality. And his outrage at the meeting opening with a prayer, that vividly illustrates his strong anti-religious stance and his passionate defense of secular governance.
Separation of church and state.
Absolutely. This wasn't just about gay rights. It was about the fundamental separation of church and state, a core tenet of his anarchist leanings. Where individual freedoms are paramount and government should remain totally neutral on matters of faith. Is a powerful demonstration of his willingness to stand up for what he believes in, regardless of personal convenience or how popular his stance is. He sees imposing religion in civic life as a direct infringement on individual liberty.
He even channeled his atheism into this unconventional, almost defiant act of charity in 2013.
The Tornado Relief Fundraiser.
Yeah. He initiated an appeal that raised nearly $126,000 for Rebecca Vitzman and her family. Their home was destroyed by that massive tornado in Moore, Oklahoma.
Huge amount of money.
And he specifically supported her because she had publicly declared she was an atheist right after the tornado hit on camera. He admired her courage in doing that in a predominantly Christian state, but he stated he did it as a big fuck you or out of spite.
Chuckles. Charity out of spite. Only Stanhope.
Can spite really be a valid motivator for good deeds? And what does this reveal about the complex nature of human compassion, particularly in Stanhope's case?
That's a truly fascinating question, isn't it? And for Stanhope, I think the answer is unequivocally yes. Spite can be a powerful motivator for good deeds. This act, while undeniably charitable and resulting in significant aid for a family in crisis.
No question, it helped them immensely.
Right. But it's framed in Stanhope's characteristic provocative manner. It was motivated not just by pure altruism, but by this powerful desire to challenge prevalent religious narratives and to support those who stand apart from the societal norm.
So supporting her atheism was key.
For Stanhope, in a state often seen as part of the Bible Belt, Rebecca Vitzman's public declaration of atheism was an act of courage, intellectual honesty, something he wanted to champion. So while the outcome was beneficial, his stated motivation was also that big fayu to the prevailing religious culture. Using charity as a vehicle for ideological reinforcement, not just pure unadulterated benevolence.
Complex motivations.
It reveals a complex, often contradictory nature of human compassion, where even a cynical anti-religious stance can fuel profound acts of kindness, albeit with a deliberately provocative twist. It's compassion with a point to make.
His broader ethical positions further align with this philosophy of individual liberty and skepticism. He describes himself as unequivocally pro-choice and pro-drug.
Consistent with his libertarian anarchist views.
And in an interview with PETA, he also critically addressed the use of wild animals for entertainment purposes and the fur trade. These positions aren't just isolated, are they? They fit into a coherent worldview.
Absolutely. These positions consistently align with that libertarian, or more accurately now, anarchist ethos of individual freedom and a deep skepticism towards systems that exploit or control.
Across the board.
Yeah. Whether it's bodily autonomy and reproductive rights, pro-choice, personal choices regarding substances, pro-drug, or critiquing systems that exploit animals for human gain, his PETA interview, it's all part of a cohesive worldview. He champions the individual's right to make choices free from governmental or societal interference, and critiques institutions or practices that exert control or cause harm. It's a comprehensive rejection of various forms of perceived authoritarianism, applying his principles across a wide spectrum of social and ethical issues.
His personal life, too, seems to actively challenge societal norms. He lives out his philosophy in his everyday existence.
He walks the walk, so to speak.
Yeah. In 2002, he and his then-girlfriend Renee Morrison staged a fake marriage ceremony in Las Vegas. He later admitted it was mocking the institution of marriage and not legitimate.
Mocking marriage in Vegas. Seems about right.
He also dated comedian Betsy Wise for about 18 months. Then around 2005, he met his current partner, Amy Bingo Bingaman. He refers to her fluidly as both his girlfriend and his wife, and they live together in Bisbee. This fluidity in his relationship seems like a rejection of traditional labels and expectations.
His mock marriage, his fluid description of his relationship with Bingo, it strongly underscores his rejection of traditional marital conventions. For Stanhope, these aren't just personal choices. They're active statements against societal expectations and institutions he views as antiquated or unnecessary.
He doesn't care about the labels.
No. He's not interested in adhering to labels or legal frameworks that he perceives as limiting or hypocritical. It's a living embodiment of his philosophy, where personal autonomy dictates the terms of his relationships, unconstrained by conventional labels or societal expectations. He creates his own rules for defining partnership, which perfectly aligns with his anarchist leanings, individual freedom and self-determination, even in the most intimate aspects of life.
And on the topic of family and procreation, Stanhope holds a deeply controversial view that he's very public about.
The anti-children stance.
Yeah, he is openly opposed to having children, citing overpopulation as a primary reason. He and Renee Morrison actually opted for an abortion, and he subsequently underwent a vasectomy. This is an incredibly personal and definitive stance to take so publicly.
It reveals a deeply held and, again, highly controversial stance on procreation, one rooted in both environmental concerns and a very personal philosophy about individual responsibility. It's another powerful example of how Stanhope takes an uncompromising position on issues many people consider sacrosanct.
He follows through on his beliefs.
Absolutely. His actions supporting an abortion, getting a vasectomy, demonstrate his willingness to follow his convictions completely, no matter how unpopular or challenging they might be to societal norms. For him, it's about making a conscious choice not to contribute to what he views as a global problem of overpopulation and exercising complete autonomy over his own body and life choices. It's a radical but consistent application of his belief in individual control and skepticism towards societal pressures to conform.
His public image is also just inextricably linked to his personal habits, blurring the lines between the man and the persona. He's widely known for heavy alcohol consumption, calls himself drunk.
Yeah, the drinking is a big part of the image.
In a 2011 interview, he even stated the last time he was sober on stage was way back in 2003.
Wow. 8 years of performing not sober at that point.
He's also known for dressing in unpretentious thrift store clothing. Is this simply who he is, or is it also a carefully cultivated aspect of his anti-establishment image?
That's a great question, and I suspect it's probably both. His open embrace of his drunk persona, his unpretentious style of dress, they aren't merely habits. They are integral contributions to his anti-establishment image.
So it's authentic and strategic?
I think so. It's an authentic reflection of his lifestyle that feeds directly into his stage persona, reinforcing the idea that he is this everyman, yet a highly intellectual and observant one who lives by his own rules, unconcerned with appearances or societal expectations.
Relatable to some, maybe.
Definitely. This lack of pretense, the self-confessed flaws, making incredibly relatable to a certain segment of the audience who appreciate that raw, unfiltered honesty. It adds to the authenticity that his audience expects and appreciates. He doesn't project an image of perfection or clean living. He presents himself as this flawed, cynical observer of the world, and that authenticity is a huge part of his appeal. It's a very deliberate rejection of the polished, often manufactured image of many celebrities.
These deeply personal beliefs and life choices, they really aren't just background details, are they?
Right.
They seem to be the very fabric of his creative output. You see them in every album, every book he releases, even his podcasts. It's all interconnected.
Completely. His life is his material.
Let's explore that output now. Let's look at the Stanhope legacy, works, and lasting impact.
Okay, his body of work.
Doug Stanhope has an incredibly prolific discography. It spans from 1998 right up to the present day. His albums consistently chart very highly within the comedy genre, which really demonstrates a dedicated fan base.
Yeah, he sells records or downloads these days.
Right. Just to highlight a few, Oslo. Burning the Bridge to Nowhere from 2011 hit number one on the comedy albums chart, number two on Heat Seekers. Before Turning the Gun on Himself in 2012, famously named after that phrase, he noticed in news articles also hit number one on comedy albums.
Great title. Very Stanhope.
Totally. Beer Hall Putsch in 2013, number one comedy. No Place Like Home in 2016, also number one. And notably filmed in Bisbee, Arizona.
And produced by Johnny Depp.
Sorry. Produced by Johnny Depp, exactly. Papa Vodka presents. An Evening with Doug Stanhope in 2017, another number one comedy album.
He has a lot of number ones for an unbookable guy.
It's impressive. He started strong, too, with albums like The Great White Stanhope back in 98, Sicko in 99, and he continues to release new material. The Dying of a Last Breed in 2020, Discount Meat just this year in 2024. That's a consistent output of high-performing, raw comedy.
The consistent high charting of his albums clearly demonstrates a dedicated and significant fan base. It proves that his niche, provocative style actually has remarkable mainstream appeal within the comedy genre. This isn't just a small cult following. He consistently tops charts alongside more conventional comedians.
Which shows there's an audience for it.
Exactly. It indicates a substantial audience craving his unique brand of humor. And his partnership with Roadrunner Records is interesting, too.
A rock label?
Yeah, originally a rock and metal label. Yeah. They launched a new comedy label specifically for him with Oslo. That further indicates this crossing over into a more rock or alternative sensibility.
Fits his vibe.
Totally. It's not the typical path for a comedian. And it reinforces his position as an artist who appeals to audiences looking for something raw, edgy, uncompromising, much like rock music often is. It's a testament to his ability to carve out this unique space that transcends traditional comedic boundaries. Shows there's a real hunger for comedy that challenges and provokes, rather than just passively entertains. And his album titles alone often hint at the dark, satirical themes within, like Before Turning the Gun on Himself, perfectly encapsulating that cynical gaze at humanity.
Beyond the stage and recordings, Stanhope has also established himself as an author, with books that really dig deep into his personal experiences, his philosophy, offering a more extended, intimate look at his mind.
Right, the books give you more context.
He released Fun with Pedophiles, The Best of Baiting, back in 2006. In 2016, he published Digging Up Mother, A Love Story.
The one about his mom, with the depth forward.
Exactly. A deeply personal book about his life with his mother, Then came This Is Not Fame, a From What I Rememoir in 2017, a collection of stories about being an infamous comedian, this one with a foreword by Dr. Drew Pinsky.
Dr. Drew. Okay, another interesting connection.
And in 2020, he released the audiobook No Encore for the Donkey. What do these books add to our understanding of Stanhope beyond what we get from his stand-up?
I think his books offer a deeper, more reflective exploration of the complex themes present in his stand-up, particularly the intensely personal digging up mother.
That one seems key.
It provides this rare, unfiltered, extended look into his relationship with his mother. A subject he often touched upon in his comedy, sure, but here it's in a more developed narrative form, allowing for greater nuance, maybe more emotional depth. It's a very raw, unflinching look at a difficult relationship.
And the celebrity forewords, Depp, Dr. Drew.
What's fascinating there is that these forewords highlight his unexpected connections, the respect he's garnered from influential personalities outside the traditional comedy circuit. It further validates his unique artistic standing. This Is Not Fame, for example, offers insights into the realities of being a controversial comedian, the unique challenges, the absurd encounters, the constant battle between personal life and public persona. These books aren't just companions to his comedy. They feel like essential texts for understanding the full scope of his philosophical and personal journey.
He's also been a real pioneer in the podcasting world, finding a medium that seems perfectly suited to his long-form conversational style.
Yeah, podcasting feels tailor-made for him.
He debuted the Doug Stanhope podcast back in 2013, recorded right out of his home in Bisbee. By 2014, it was hosted by the All Things Comedy Network. And just recently, in 2024, he joined fellow comedians Brendan Walsh and Sean Green to launch the Get to the Points podcast on Green's Sports Gambling Podcast Network. Why do podcasts provide such an ideal platform for Stanhope?
Podcasts are absolutely ideal for Stanhope's conversational, long-form, completely unfiltered style. They allow for these extended discussions, explorations of his ideas, far beyond the constraints of a tightly timed stand-up set.
More room to breathe.
Exactly. Unlike a comedy special, a podcast allows for digressions, spontaneous riffs, a deeper dive into current events or personal anecdotes, all delivered with his signature candor. His early adoption of podcasting, especially recording it from his home in Bisbee, further emphasizes that independent spirit, his desire to connect directly with his audience without intermediaries or needing a polished studio environment.
Raw and direct.
It's a perfect medium for his brand of raw, unedited honesty, creating this intimate, almost confessional space where he can just be himself completely. And the Get to the Points podcast shows he's continuing to evolve, bringing his unique perspective to new formats and audiences, proving the versatility of his voice.
Stanhope has also had some really high-profile collaborations and even some controversies that have only added to his legend and demonstrated the real-world impact of his outspoken nature. His friendship with Johnny Depp is particularly noteworthy, given Depp's huge global superstar status.
Yeah, the Depp connection is fascinating.
Depp befriended Stanhope in Europe. Back in 2014, Depp apparently had an unknown project in mind for him. This collaboration deepened when Depp wrote the foreword for Digging Up Mother and later produced Stanhope's 2015 special, No Place Like Home. This is kind of an unexpected pairing, isn't it? What does it say about Stanhope's appeal?
This unexpected friendship and professional collaboration, it definitely brought Stanhope a significantly higher profile. And it further validated his artistic standing, demonstrating that even Hollywood A-listers appreciate his unique brand of humor, his uncompromising artistic vision.
So Depp saw something authentic there.
It seems so. What's fascinating is how these connections happened organically, stemming from a genuine appreciation for his work and authenticity, rather than through typical industry networking or calculated career moves. Depp clearly recognized a kindred spirit in Stanhope, someone who operates outside the conventional rules, values raw, unfiltered honesty. Their collaboration elevated Stanhope's visibility without asking him to compromise his artistic integrity, which is a rare feat in the entertainment world. It truly speaks to the universal resonance of a genuine, if provocative, voice.
However, this connection also led directly to a significant public controversy. In June 2016, actress Amber Heard sued Stanhope.
Right, the defamation lawsuit.
For defamatory claims that she was blackmailing her then ex-husband, Johnny Depp. Stanhope had publicly defended Depp, his friend, during their very contentious divorce. Heard later dropped the lawsuit in the aftermath of her and Depp's $7 million divorce settlement.
So the suit was dropped, but it was still a major event.
Right. This incident, while ultimately resolved, it really highlights the very real consequences of Stanhope's outspoken nature, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. This incident, stemming directly from his fierce loyalty to a friend and his willingness to speak his mind publicly, underscores the very real-world consequences of his outspoken nature. While it resolved without formal repercussions for Stanhope, it highlights the personal risks he's willing to take when he feels compelled to defend someone or speak his truth, regardless of the potential legal or public relations fallout.
Loyalty over self-preservation.
It seems that way. For Stanhope, his words have weight, both on and off stage, and he doesn't shy away from using them to support those he cares about, even when it puts him right in the crosshairs of a high-profile legal battle. It's a stark reminder that his commitment to honesty and loyalty extends far beyond the confines of a comedy club. It bleeds into his personal life and becomes part of his public legacy.
Despite all this, his career continues to thrive. It shows remarkable longevity, sustained creative output. He announced a big Fall Autumn tour of the U.S. and U.K. and Ireland back in 2022.
Still pulling in crowds globally.
And in 2023, he produced and starred in a film called The Road Dog with his former partner, Christine Hoch.
Producing and starring in a movie now, too, expanding his reach.
Yeah.
His continued touring, these new projects, they demonstrate his sustained career and ongoing artistic output, showing that his influence continues well into the 2020s. He remains a relevant and active voice, consistently producing new material, exploring new formats like film production with The Road Dog, and connecting with his audience globally. This continuous engagement further cements his legacy as this tireless, uncompromising performer who, despite his unbookable persona, has found a way to not only survive but actually thrive on his own terms in a constantly evolving entertainment landscape. His longevity proves there's a lasting demand for his brand of brutal honesty.
So as we bring our deep dive to a close here, what can we truly take away from the extraordinary journey of Doug Stanhope, a comedian who seems to embody the very definition of an outsider?
Doug Stanhope is, without a doubt, a comedian who consistently pushes boundaries. He wholeheartedly embraces discomfort and lives this utterly unfiltered life, seemingly turning every single experience into material.
Nothing is off limits.
Nothing. We've seen how his unique blend of dark humor, his political evolution from libertarianism to full-blown anarchism, and his unwavering willingness to tackle controversial personal and societal issues head-on have defined his career. He's carved out this space where uncomfortable truths aren't just discussed, they're actively celebrated, often with this wry, confrontational smirk. Challenging norms, both personally and professionally, never shying away from the messiness of existence. He's a figure who thrives in the margins, creating his own rules for engagement, both in comedy and in life.
It really makes you wonder, doesn't it? In an increasingly sensitive, interconnected world, what is the enduring value of a figure like Doug Stanhope?
Yeah, what purpose does he serve now?
Does his refusal to compromise, even if it means offending, alienating some people, does it serve a crucial purpose by forcing us to examine uncomfortable truths, question our deepest assumptions? Or does his provocative stance simply add to the societal noise, maybe contributing to a culture of outrage?
It's a tough balance.
As you listening reflect on his unyielding perspective, what unique insight does his brand of raw honesty offer about freedom of speech, about personal responsibility, and about the very nature of uncomfortable truth in comedy today? It's definitely a question worth pondering long after the laughter or maybe the cringing fades.
Indeed it is. And that's our deep dive into Doug Stanhope. Thanks for joining us.